Welcome to At Home in Chattanooga, your go-to podcast for scenic city living, real estate tips, and expert insights on building, lifestyle, and the local economy. Sponsored by Pratt Home Builders. Discover what's new in new construction at prattliving.com.
Hey guys, it's Brittany with Pratt Home Builders here. And so excited to be here today with some extremely special guests. I'm sure, unless you have been living under a rock, you have had to have heard about Chattanooga becoming the first national park city in North America.
Yep.
Which is so exciting. So really feel blessed to have Brian Smith, director of the National Park, Chattanooga, the National Park City. If I'm butchering that, please correct me.
Okay, that works.
And then Dan Raven Ellison,
Yeah. Who
is the founder of the entire This Is Your Brainchild, National Park City, and there are two others in the world, right?
That's right, London.
You're the third
after London and Adelaide, yeah.
Okay. And so, Brian, you have been working on this. I feel like it's been years.
It's been about a good 2 years or so that we did this. So initially, we found about the idea, and there was our former Parks and Outdoors director, Scott Martin, that came in and brought this idea to us, and also working a little bit with World Urban Parks. And so we thought, maybe could Chattanooga fit in something like this as the sort of category of this idea? And so the initial kind of application, we sent it off to the National Park City Foundation and said, you know, I think Chattanooga could do this. I think Chattanooga's got what it takes to be, you know, culturally rich, historic. Obviously, we've got the nature that's all around us too, and the great organizations and people that are making this a much better city. And so we submitted the first little application, which after that, we had to really work on 23 criteria, if you will, that kind of highlighted the different things that we have going on in our city. I did mostly with our organizations, anywhere from Tennessee Aquarium to Reflection Riding, the Chattanooga Zoo, and the list goes on. So we got everybody kind of together, and we created a charter, and that charter has 7 points in there. Things like we want to make sure we create unrivaled access to nature when we build and when we are educating, you know, a little bit more stewardship and education. Another one is food and agriculture. So we have these different charters that our teams have come together and said, we're doing the work, but then where can we identify some gaps? And so all that process, and plus the history and how everything came together, we created what is called a journey book. And this is a digital journey book that talks briefly about Chattanooga being the dirtiest city in America, but then it kind of really fast forwards to what we've been able to do in the last 20 years. And when you put all that combined, I told the foundation, we've already are a national park city. Just give it to us already.
Yeah.
So, and you know, Dan's here to kind of explore Chattanooga a little bit. We had a peer review team here a couple of months ago, and I think we wowed them. And so they went back and immediately said, take it. You're a national park city. But that doesn't mean the work stops. We still got plenty of work to do, and that's what some of our action plans will identify as well. So, and this, it will continue to be a work in progress.
Yeah, you just got to the starting line, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Dan, had you been here as part of that peer review process, I guess? Is it your first trip to Chattanooga?
This is my first trip to Chattanooga, especially for an event tomorrow to celebrate this truly historic moment. But there was a larger team of both people coming over from Britain, but also from across North America, who took part in that peer review team. And a peer review is very much about experts from other national park cities, as well as experts in the field, making an assessment to make sure that there's a good fit for the city.
So what brought this about? How long have, to be honest, I really had not been aware that there were a couple other national park cities. So when did those come about and how?
Do you know what? I mean, the origin story for me might well begin in the United States. I mean, so I live in England, and I campaigned to make London the world's first national park city. But going back 40 odd years, my dad was serving in the British Army and came to Fort Eustis to Newport News in Virginia, and was there helping to train up parts of the US forces. And during that time, my parents took myself and my brothers to over 20 national parks across the United States, from the Everglades to Yosemite to Yellowstone, all over the place. And I'm pretty sure that during that period, you know, I became pretty hardwired into the value of national parks, both in terms of the nature value, in terms of the job they do for protecting nature, the job they do in terms of giving us space to be healthier and well and to enjoy ourselves, But, you know, growing up as well, you become more aware of the other services that national parks provide as well. You know, not just for the sake of nature itself, but for example, our cities would be flooding more often if our national parks weren't doing pretty heavy lifting in terms of storing water. And there were many other services that national parks offer for us as well. And then fast forward about 20 years, and I had my son, and I was doing a job for National Geographic at the time, celebrating their 125th anniversary. And we visited all of the UK's national parks in a really short period of time. Interestingly, as a father, giving my son a similar experience to what my parents had given me. And it was during that journey that I began to notice that when you look to the British national parks and you look at national parks around the world, they represent every major type of internationally recognized habitat that you can imagine, right? So there are glacier national parks, there's desert national parks, there's rainforest national parks. Every single type of internationally recognized habitat is in there, apart from one. And can you guess what that one is?
Humans.
Yeah, towns and towns and cities. You know, and you think about where I was living at the time, London. London's a city of 15,000 species of wildlife. It's one of the most biologically diverse regions of the UK. There are more pairs of breeding peregrine falcon there, the world's fastest animal, than there are in Yosemite National Park, and in Britain, the Peak District National Park, combined, right? So I began to wonder, like, what is it about human beings and urban nature, the badgers, the foxes, that meant that we were worth less than these rural spaces? And that made no sense to me, really, because in my mind, you know, an urban fox is as valuable as a desert fennec fox or an arctic fox. It just happens to live in the city. And then, so my starting point was thinking that cities were missing from that family of national parks. But then what I came to realize over time through this campaign and working with other people, that what's really missing is that national park thinking is missing from our cities. And what I mean by that is that city thinking tends to be fractured, short-term, split between lots of people and places. National park thinking tends to be large-scale, long-term, holistic, systems-based, and it gives you a purpose and a vision for that landscape that's a real gift. Because it means that everyone, everywhere, everything in that landscape, even though they might be doing it in a contested way, is driving towards a common purpose. And that common purpose is to have a better relationship with nature and to enjoy ourselves. So imagine then, let's imagine that a city's purpose at the moment is it's largely a marketplace of people and ideas, products, surfaces, a place where we can watch like Netflix and whatever else, right? That's roughly what a city is. So if we can give the city a gift of its purpose also being to have a better relationship with nature and to enjoy ourselves, and for that purpose to not just benefit the city, but maybe people in that city's relationship with nature beyond that city itself, wouldn't that be a lovely thing? Mm-hmm. And I think that can be brought to life partially through what government can do, but it's also definitely about what a four-year-old can do as well. So yeah, pretty wide story arc of where the idea comes about. But I think that for a lot of people, the idea won't make sense at first because you think, well, a national park is, it's this remote, wild, rural thing over here, and a city is something else. But just like I said, in London, having 15,000 species of wildlife and having as many trees as people, right here in Chattanooga, it is also a biodiversity hotspot for the United States. It's something like 9/10 of many different types of species group. Like, of course, the whole of the United States, in terms of biodiversity, mm-hmm. are all found right here. There are as many trees as people. There's nearly 1,000 non-profits, whether you like this or not, non-profits for every citizen in this city. No, it's the other way around. There's nearly 1,000 citizens for every non-profit in the city, which has its pros and positives and negatives. But what that means is that there's an incredible range of diversity of people, life, ideas right here. And the National Park City is a way of just dialing that up, cranking that up even more.
So how have the other cities sort of, how do they compare to Chattanooga? And when did they become part of your initiative? How many years ago?
It took a long time to campaign for London. I mean, like, basically people were saying that I was bonkers, that people involved with the campaign was bonkers. Like, how could you make London a national park city? That just didn't make sense. But on the whole, what happens is you tell the story and explain why, and people go, oh yeah, like, why shouldn't we value urban life as much as rural life? And of course we need urban habitats to be great places for people and nature. Like, it's as obvious, and it's almost like we've inherited this very old, 100-year-old idea of separating off people and nature, which has been very problematic for the world as a whole. and also it doesn't help people either. So it took a long time, but eventually 2019, London became the world's first national park city. It's a grassroots campaign supported by the Mayor of London and backed by government agencies. And then in Adelaide, the Minister for Environment for South Australia heard about it and said, well, Adelaide is well known as being one of the most livable cities in the world. Like, I think Adelaide would make a great national park city. And we were like, yeah, we agree. It's a no-brainer. And then Chattanooga got in contact and said, what about us? And again, to be honest, it's like, of course. I mean, how this place is already a national park city. It's already been doing so much of national park city work, yeah, like you say in the journey book, for generations, actually. Mm-hmm. And I think the story of Chattanooga, actually, what the city's been through and what it's achieving, I think is like inspiring for cities across America and across the world.
Since Chattanooga became an official national park city, have each of you received a lot of buzz from other cities kind of reaching out? What's that been like, aftermath?
There's been a couple cities that I've been interested in. As a matter of fact, when we were talking to some folks yesterday, places like Roanoke, Virginia, emailed and said, hey, I'd like to learn a little bit more about this. But I think as the message sort of spreads that cities can do this, that city government can get behind it, or it can be truly just a grassroots movement. And the way that we sort of did it by celebrating and honoring the organizations that are doing the work already, and then people that just are, you know, building their backyards or building home communities that are a little bit more geared towards community. The other cities are doing that too. So this is a way to celebrate that. And then of course, when you have the name and the excitement as well, that gets people thinking, what does this mean? What can I do with this? And that's where you can really sort of attack the everyday person that says, well, you can visit some of these organizations that are doing the great work, or you can just do the great work that's in your backyard by planting your own native garden, doing more walks in places like here at Sturkey Farm, where you can just walk 14 miles on a trail right in the middle of Chattanooga, the city here. So other cities, you know, we're a little interested at first. We beat them, sorry. But more cities, I think, will come on board with this. And we hope so, because, again, each city has a good reason to celebrate what they're doing to connect people with nature.
I think it's also that it's, you know, I think that cities becoming greener, healthier, wilder, cooler, better for nature, that's not like a nice to have. It's not just a luxury that should be there for people who can afford it. I think it's something that's absolutely imperative for our own species and other species as well. Like, it's absolutely necessary. So let's not beat around the bush. You know, what this is about is people living longer lives, healthier lives, those lives themselves being richer for longer. When I say richer, I don't just mean like the dollar. I mean, you know, that a more joyful life. That's the stuff we're dealing with here. And that's because we know that the evidence shows that when people have a better relationship with nature and they spend more time outdoors and they're active with other people outdoors that they enjoy spending time with, people live longer, healthier, happier lives. And when people spend more time in nature and they're more respectful of it, then nature benefits from that, that as well. And of course, people are part of nature, so respecting that relationship is a critical part of it as well. But this isn't just a nice to have. And I think that when you think about cities across the US and around the world, whether it's called a national park city or whether it's another way of doing it, you know, it's an imperative that we make this sort of work happen.
I think it's really special too that it's happening at this time in Chattanooga's history as we move forward and we can be more long-term minded. I think that that's really special. So I know that you were kind of joking before we got started, but that this is just the starting point. But what can we look forward to, you know, from this point forward?
I think on probably our end, Chattanooga is going to continue to grow no matter what. So, but are there maybe better practices when we're building? Is there better sustainable ways? And we've come a long way, and there's some great ways that we are doing building in creative ways as well. So that's number one. Yes, you know, Chattanooga is not perfect. Yes, there's some other things and issues that city government is working on. But also at the same time, our outdoors is our competitive advantage, both for our own residents and for tourism as well. So we need to continue to work on providing access to these locations, providing maybe more ADA accessible playgrounds and trail access, working with kids in the urban core to make sure they can continue to get in some of these outlying areas so they can enjoy nature just as much, or maybe even enjoying nature inside their neighborhood as well. So those are some of those long-term ones. And the same thing with our organizations, all having plans of continuing to connect trails, possibly connecting with the Cumberland Trail that that rivals something like the Appalachian Trail that could run right through here in Chattanooga. We want to create more greenways that can connect more neighborhoods to the Riverwalk. And, you know, the list goes on. And things like the city has done with this as being a grass tops and a grassroots movement. Just in the last couple of years, the city's never had a natural resources team. Now we have scientists that are creating buffer zones along creeks, that are putting in native gardens. We got one right over here that's full of native plants. You know, the list goes on. The city really hasn't done that really ever. So now we're putting a little bit more effort towards that. So we can continue to grow. We can continue to work on day-to-day city things, but we can also continue as a city to make that city greener, healthier, and wilder. And this doesn't just mean nature too. This is also outdoor sport and play. So we're one of the biggest softball meccas here in the country. And you know, we saw $61 million economic boost just in softball here. That's still getting outside and still playing. So we want to make sure we continue to build on access for that. And then all of our organizations are doing the exact same thing. And then the science behind a lot of it. I'll take the aquarium, for instance. Beautiful fish tank right downtown. Everybody loves and goes to it. 90% of the people go and they see what all is there, but don't realize that across the river is the Tennessee River Institute, where they're literally saving fish that are on the brink of being extinct, Laurel darts, right now, and they're also raising sturgeon to put right back into the Tennessee River. So that work continues to go on. So again, it's a celebration, and it is a starting point right at the same time. So yay, we got it, but let's continue to work. Yeah, and work together.
Yeah, and I think that, like a lot of people as well, might look at Chattanooga becoming a national park city and go, well, again, how does that make sense? Because like national parks are these incredible places we go to that almost feel utopian in terms of how beautiful and incredible they are. But what people might forget is the reason why those founding members who created the national park movement did so was because those landscapes, those communities faced problems, right? And if we had not created the national parks, we would not have protected those landscapes, those habitats, that nature at all. And we'd be far the poorer as a society, as societies around the world, if that work hadn't taken place. But the work they continue to do is one of protection. So then we imagine, what does protection look like in an urban environment? So we can still protect an urban landscape, we can still protect urban life, but we just do it differently. So in a traditional national park, that might be about having in the United States case, federal government having an agency that is very top down with national park rangers and everything else. And that's one way of doing it. In the United Kingdom, we have thousands of people living on our national parks. They're working landscapes, often made up of farms and other things. Very, very different type of national park. They're delivered through partnership. And then in parts of Canada, Brazil, elsewhere in the world, they have national parks that are, yes, protected through policy, but they're delivered and managed by indigenous people who have often lived there for thousands of years. So for me, then, a national park city is about combining all three types of national park together. You want to have the top-down government policy to help make great things happen in the city, for sidewalks, walkways, to create the architecture and the infrastructure that can enable communities to come together to make things happen together. So you want the government bit, you want partnerships between businesses and the nonprofit sector to exchange ideas, to have meetings, to make sure that new buildings are the best possible buildings, to have that sort of partnership working, get finance going. But then so much of it is about what 200,000 people here in Chattanooga can do as individuals themselves. And since the beginning of the National Park City movement, we've always sort of thrown around these sort of two key questions. One, which is about inviting people to imagine the possible. And the second one being really to challenge people to make the difference. So the first one is, what if? And we can do this at a governmental level, and we can also bring it down to like a child. So like, what if there was more outdoor learning in schools? What if there were more field trips? What if there was more free play at recess for longer before going back in to do your math, right? What if more streets were appropriate for children to play outside? And what if, in terms of the rivers here, there was more wildlife? What if we could hear more birdsong? What if there were more rope swings throughout the city? What if more people walked rather than drove more often, more of the time? And then you can follow up those what if questions with why not? Well, why not? And some of the why nots are things where it's down to the government to do something, because without that sidewalk or without that play equipment, it's actually quite hard for you to do things safely. That's part of the social contract. The other part of it is, if I want more walk in the city, I can walk more. If I want less litter in the city, I can either not drop litter or I can pick up litter, right? If I want my children to play outside more, you know, you can let your children play outside more. So there are all these things which are very powerful, very small things that, when added up, can really add up to something quite significant as a society, where you're not only making a difference for yourself individually, but when you share the story of the things you're doing in the city, you shift culture, and that can change literally the landscape, but also, going back to the point I made before, you know, healthier, longer lives.
It's really exciting that we could potentially coexist that way. Even, I love your comments on the animals. I'm a big animal person. And so I feel like this is just all, you're speaking my language, but in terms of, you know, the mindfulness, because we know Chattanooga is a great place to live. I'm actually a rare native from here. Are you native, friend?
I grew up in Mississippi, but my quick story is I was on the Boy Scouts, and we would take our summer trips here to Chattanooga to raft the rivers, go to Rock City, so on and so forth. So I fell in love with Chattanooga at an early age. And so when I started my career, I thought if I ever land in Chattanooga, that would be great, and came here about 15 years ago. And I had aspirations to move on to bigger cities in my world of television, but ended up staying here because it's great. And now I'm living vicariously through my daughter, going through the same places and same locations that I did when I first fell in love with Chattanooga.
And it is such a beautiful place to live. You know, I think it's like, you can certainly, in a way, selfishly feel like, oh, I want it to grow. But then it's easy to see why it's such a wonderful place to live. But with that, and I actually grew up on a farm, so that's where it's always, you know, really at the forefront of my mind. Like, how can we grow? Because humans need places to live and quality places to live, and that's really important. But also, you know, when I see deer running around or something like that, I'm very mindful of, you know, the how we build homes and how we create communities, because really both sides of that, the humans and then all of the other creatures, you know, how we coexist is really important. So that's what gets me excited about how this could be the rising tide that lifts all boats in terms of thought processes.
Yeah, so, you know, I can speak a bit to that in terms of my context in England. And I think that it's certainly the case that depending on where building is taking place, whether it's brownfield sites or even whether it's greenfield sites, it's not the case that new development necessarily leads to less biodiversity or less good outcomes for people or nature. The right kind of development, the right density in the right places with the right services can make life better for people, and it can lead to better outcomes for nature as well if it's done in the right way. And certainly, I think the balance then of where development goes in is a really key thing to look at. But good quality development does not have to have negative outcomes. And the other thing is that I think that the evidence shows that people are often willing to pay a premium for a better quality of environment. Of course they are. And a better quality of environment often means like more nature and more green spaces. You know, that's literally how it works. But then the challenge, I think, is to work out how to have the policies that means that when you do have areas that have green space, that you also make sure that you can have the housing available to people who couldn't normally afford to be in those places. So you don't just end up having, you know, one side of the city rich with all the green space and other parts of the city poor and it's all grey. And I've walked across Mexico City, Mumbai, lots of cities for projects in my career. And there are, you know, some cities where you can really see basically what happens in terms of just tree canopy cover as you go from richer to poorer places. And essentially, in some cities, poorer places have less shade.
Yep.
Right?
There's the heat maps and pollution maps and so much data on this and just the seemingly small ways it can affect physical health as well.
Right. So if a national park city is for everyone, everywhere, every day, then the hope would be that as cities are designed into the future, that planners can take inspiration from the national park city and residents can take inspiration from the national park city to be asking for these kinds of things to be built in and as standard going forward. But it must be said as well, though, that I think that London National Park City, which I campaigned for, would have never been successful if we'd been campaigning for it to take on planning policy or to take on codes or take on new types of taxes and things. We've been very careful to stay clear of that. So there are some national park cities in the world where government will align some of those things that will help to help a national park city to flourish in some of those areas. But actually, national park cities can also do a very good job without those changes because of the things that individuals can do. You know, I gave you those what if, why nots, but there's some really simple examples where, for example, whether you've just got a balcony or you've got a garden, planting some native plants, not using astroturf, having less asphalt, these kinds of things can make a big difference to issues around flooding, temperatures, but also biodiversity and how fun those spaces are to play in as well. And so those actually are policies around individual citizens making rules for their own lives. And like I say, again, you know, that can impact their own life straight away, but on the multiplier effect can be very significant indeed. And I think that when that's demonstrated to government, that can help to give policymakers of government more confidence to then bring in some of those sort of supporting policies as well. But you know, in Chattanooga and London, we haven't seen any, you know, significant changes in policy or code that I think people should be worried about. This is very much about what citizens can drive for themselves.
And I think in some of our preliminary, you know, conversations, just in the excitement of this, is I've followed it for so long, and I feel like it's such a positive to Chattanooga. Just, can you speak to how it's more vibrance-minded? I feel like my takeaways have been that it's about curiosity and it's about creating a vibrant city. Can you speak to that a little bit?
You know, and kind of look at some of the building and some of the other things that as we grow, but we also need to look at what we've already been able to establish here in town. As I mentioned, our natural resources team with the city, the first time we've ever had that. So now we just received a $6 million grant to plant more trees downtown. So some of these historic areas that have no shade and are historically urban heat islands, the city is going back in and planting more trees in parks that we already have. And those are just some examples, creating rain gardens in historically flooded areas in the city too. So the city has got to be doing some work and being held accountable on some of this as well. And that makes a more vibrant area. Also too, having a culturally rich city, it makes a very vibrant city too. So we have some of the best public art around, especially for a city our size, over 200 public art pieces from murals to a sculpture park. That makes for a vibrant city. So a city that really comes back and sort of cares for itself makes a vibrant city. But also too, some areas don't have the best parks. Some areas have better parks than others. So part of the goal is to create a great park for everyone to enjoy. Because you may have a park right down the road and we say, it's only a few minutes to walk down there. But if it's not attractive, no one's going to go there. So we want to continue to make those areas vibrant for the residents that are already here, and then also as areas grow too. We know that as we grow further out away from the city, there's not really much park space left there. A lot of that is just going to become development, but for the city, how do we connect people that are moving in those areas closer to places like Enterprise South? How can we get them closer to trails that are here and connecting everybody that way? That indeed makes a vibrant city as well. So I think that's sort of the government side of things and then what we're trying to do there. And then all the organizations, as I mentioned before, too, doing the work that they are doing. You know, what more can we do at Reflection Writing? What more can the Chattanooga Zoo do to educate and help out the species that live in this area? They're already doing great work, but they're going to continue to do more, which continues, again, to add to a vibrant city. All the way down to the Creative Discovery Museum, which is one of our partners as well. They want more kids to play. And now, because of this idea, the Creative Discovery Museum's downtown, then it's two blocks, and then it's the river. There's two hotels that are in the way, and so how do we get kids that have been playing here at the Creative Discovery Museum all morning to get them down to the river in an exciting way? And we're already looking at a great little corridor working with the two hotels to get us right down to the riverfront. So it's those ideas that make a city more vibrant too. And some of that's going to take time. Some of it is, you know, pie in the sky type things, but as we often say, you kind of want to skate where the puck is going. Mm-hmm. So the puck is leading us. What can we do to go in that direction? And that's not just government, but that is also our residents. That's also, you know, anyone that comes here and visits as well. I mean, there's a reason why people come here. Let's continue to make it vibrant.
Mm. Had you said that there were about 23 metrics that it was kind of based on? Can you give us, you don't have to go through the whole list, but can you kind of give us a snapshot of what, you know, some of those were?
Yeah, well, they grouped into sort of five key areas, basically around, is it a suitable enough place and landscape? Does the team behind it have a suitable vision? Is it an inclusive enough project? And is the team capable enough to actually deliver on what they say they're going to do? So it's a combination of having that large scale, long-term vision, understanding how everyone every day in the National Park City is able to contribute. Think about having that partnership of organizations who is able to help actually bring it to life, because it can't just be a few people who've got a nice idea. You actually need to have some power to go behind it, and then making sure that there's some resources there as well. That the spirit of it is not like saying how much green space is there or how many species there are. That actually doesn't make sense when you think about it from an international perspective. There are some cities in the world that shouldn't be greener. They should be more yellow or brown, actually, because they're in deserts, mm-hmm. right? So actually, you can't just benchmark like that. And as well as that, you know, I mean, you know, well done to the people in Vienna, for example, for inheriting a fantastically green city. That's what your ancestors did for you. But what we're more interested in, Vienna would be welcome, by the way, but what we're more interested in is what's going to happen in the city in the future. And what we want to see is that the cities are becoming greener, healthier, and wilder in the future. And an analogy I quite like to make, actually, is around that when we visit Aurora National Park, a remote national park, You may have heard the phrase, you know, leave no trace. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the idea that you go to the national park, you enjoy it, but you try and have as little footprint as possible. I think what's different about an urban environment is that while we're treated as consumers that should make as little impact as possible in the remote national park, in a national park city, I'd challenge you to have as much of an impact as possible and to have a positive footprint, because there are all things we can do that can have a positive impact on the city and for that legacy actually to be seen, you know. I think that's a really critical part of it. So in terms of those 23 criteria, the relationship between London and Adelaide, for example, with Chattanooga, is not one of policing or benchmarking. It's one of camaraderie, of sharing, of collaboration. Exploring Chattanooga, I can see some things that are similar, but I'm drooling over things you have here that we don't have in the UK. I mean, you know, we have a fantastic health system, for example, okay, but we don't have like outdoors teams like you guys who are out there to help people get started on mountain biking or walking, or trying to make sure that there's sort of integrated trail systems in play going through the city. Yes, there's people working on the physical infrastructure, but not so much on the activation side, the people side of it. Very envious of that. Also, you know, the River Thames, our big river in London, was ecologically dead actually a few decades ago. But through lots of work from civic organisations, actually been brought to life again with about 300 species, which is actually not too dissimilar a story from right here. But your aquarium, our aquarium by the Thames, is full of weird tropical stuff from other places. It's a bizarre experience, and I worry for the fish. But actually, if that aquarium was all about, you know, a conservation effort around the fish that are actually in the Thames itself, like what a magical thing that would be. And I could go on and on and on. In reality, there's so many civic organisations, people going snorkelling down creeks and protecting crayfish, and people doing horticulture to help, I mentioned again, like native species, or people who are focusing on the urban forest you have here, incredible tree canopy cover, but trying to make sure that actually where people are walking and cycling, that you've got consistent canopy cover and shade where you're travelling through. So many projects like that. And when you put it together, it's really, really, really incredible. So the National Park City is trying to then say, right, well, what's also going on in Adelaide, where they're reintroducing species to rivers, and also trying to work out the best ways to cool the city. They get temperatures up to 50 degrees Celsius there. What's that in Fahrenheit?
Yeah, you're getting up to 100 plus.
Like really, really hot. And so, you know, what are the conversations you could be having here about cooling temperatures and tree canopy cover? What sort of expertise there? Or thinking about, you just mentioned before we started speaking just now about having, you know, little shelters for books and book libraries and things on the side of streets. Well, is there some way that we're doing that in London and you're doing that here, that we can cross-pollinate those ideas and actually have even better mini book libraries to share? I don't know, you know. And I think that tapping into this point that, although there's great cultural diversity between different cities and different people, we speak the same language, but we're also, you know, from very different backgrounds, very different places. Many of our anxieties around health, climate, nature, inequality, all these things are shared between our communities. And so when we have a diversity of solutions and a diversity of people coming up with ideas, we're all much the stronger if we have that exchange happening between our countries and our cities. And so, you know, that's already happening, like right now. This is happening while I'm here with a peer review teaming coming, with Adelaide, London and Chattanooga working together. And what I'd add to that as well, I think that's really exciting about Chattanooga doing this. In a city of 200,000 people, I mean, London, 8 million people, that almost makes it mystical to some cities, the idea that they could become a national park city. Adelaide too, it's like this sort of incredible city that many people have heard of, because it's, like I said, voted as this sort of livable city. It's a famous, famous world city. But most people in the world live in cities about the size of Chattanooga, actually, 300,000 people. And so for Chattanooga to become a national park city, I think will inspire many, many more cities to begin thinking about how they can join the journey and how they match up to those 23 criteria. And we'll look at them and go, actually, you know, I reckon we can do that.
And something I was kind of curious about is how you get the buy-in when folks already live here, you know, to your point earlier about all of the biodiversity within this area, having such a large percentage in this area that we take for granted.
Mm.
I'm curious, you know, in what ways maybe you've kind of inspired more of a sense of reverence or stewardship in some areas, or how you would see that unfolding. It's just been interesting over the years as a native here, and plus with my background, easy to see how much we have. I have a close relationship with nature and animals, but then I've spoken to so many people who've relocated from California who, you know, they saw that last orange tree cut down in Orange County, and they saw the growth that wasn't maybe done in such a mindful way. So how would you see, you know, ideally inspiring, not only from the government side of things, but just, you know, causing the general public to appreciate and care more?
Well, I think I'll kind of take a little bit of the first part about that. And people have kind of asked too, is this just a marketing campaign? We kind of toyed around with the word just a little bit, because that minimizes it being a marketing campaign. But yeah, it is. And I don't apologize for the fact that this is, part of this is a big marketing campaign, because I want to let people know that live here in town that they can get plugged into these organizations. I, as a city representative, can say, hey, join the city and do this, 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 this. Well, that may not fit for everybody, but there might be somebody that's interested in helping out the toads at Reflection Riding. Well, they got classes for that. Somebody that's interested in the forest schools. Someone that really wants to help support the art community and join the dance community. That's part of this as well. So part of that marketing is sharing what you can do here. And you know, one example that one of our charter members that came out of the criteria is food and agriculture. And we've got a young lady, Haley, that runs the UT Extension office that's sort of leading that campaign there. And then we have Food Forest Coalition, and we've got a couple churches that have backyard gardens there. But they've kind of come together and said, it's really hard to let people know where these free community gardens are. You can Google search it, but maybe only one or two pops up. Wouldn't it be nice to have a website or something that people could go to and see the 27 community gardens that we have here in town that are open to everybody? National Park City can do something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's putting some of those people that are in those categories. And so my challenge to people, while, you know, Dan has said, and I'll say too, that people could do these things in their own backyard, but it's also get plugged into some of these people. Because if you don't know that the people are doing, and these organizations are doing the great thing here in Chattanooga, then you think Chattanooga's not doing anything. Mm-hmm. And you don't maybe not tend to respect Chattanooga. But there are people cleaning our creeks. There are people that are saving the crawfish. Literally, is that is happening. You know, there are people that are, you know, making sure the air quality is great with the Air Pollution Bureau here. That's part of our organization as well. So encouraging people to get plugged into those organizations and learning more is a really big thing that, you know, citizens can do.
Yeah, definitely. I think that, you know, there's a number of key things that the National Park City gives, I think, that's really distinctive. So part of that is about purpose, like I already said. So it gives a purpose to the whole landscape, the whole city, of having a better relationship with nature and enjoying ourselves. Next key part, which relates to marketing, is the story. The story of the city, what it means to be in the city and the future of the city, but also for the individuals in the city, what's the story of their day, what's the story of their week, and what are they filling that with, and what are they sharing with other people? It's also a platform and a way to operate and work together and think about ways in which you can share and exchange ideas through the city. And I think that when you're talking about marketing there, I'm hearing, I like walking a lot. And for me, it's like signposts. And if you don't know where you're going and you don't have a pathway to know where you're going, well, how are you going to get there? Mm-hmm. And part of that can be good marketing, website and branding and signage. But also, you know, if you're someone who likes the outdoors and you know someone who's struggling or doesn't know the outdoor so well, that could be a family or it could be a child or it could be an elderly person, take them by the hand and take them somewhere. And it doesn't have to be going up a mountain. It could be just going and sitting on a bench in a park and using an app to work out what the bird song is, or just going to do some art or just having a picnic. But take someone who finds that harder. And then you go up the way a little bit and think about all those civic organizations who are doing amazing things. There are so many people who want to do things in their community, and they're intelligent people and they can use Google. But what they haven't got is the idea of the thing. And just to scale up that as a case in point, where I live for ages in London, the River Thames is a tidal river. You can walk nearly the whole length of it, 300 miles from the source going right out to the sea. But there's certain bits in London where you have to go in through some streets because the very old, hundreds of year old buildings are built right up against the bank of the Thames. And I'm looking at the boardwalk here going alongside your creek, and I'm thinking, what if we had a boardwalk going along the bank of the Thames? That means that then you can have a continuous journey. And I don't need to have a conversation with the engineers here to get that idea and think about what could I do to bring that into my community. Or, you know, there's the idea of the saying about some bug hotels or mini libraries and all these kinds of things as well. You just need to see it, and then people are clever enough to work it out for themselves. So organizing exchanges or little field trips within the city for people in neighborhoods that don't have those things to see those things and then go, well, actually, do you know what? I can knock some wood together. I can make that thing. But then even better still, if there's an organization around that can help to, you know, champion you doing those things, all the better. I think that, for example, the outdoors team, like I said before, helping people get out and about, walking, learning how to camp, learning how to climb, that's available as a public service. So people who maybe have been struggling to connect with nature or get outdoors can take those up. So yeah, I think there's a whole range of ways in which we can better connect people to nature and get people thinking about those things. And I think that those examples I give in terms of field trips or taking people by the hand, yeah, I know I'm talking a lot about the sort of citizens and children there. Architects and engineers can do the same thing. When I flew into land into Chattanooga a few days ago, I really noticed that, and I don't know which is best necessarily, but as a foreigner looking on with, I guess, an uneducated eye about the decisions in certain places on the outskirts of the city, is interesting those communities where there's like a cookie cutter kind of bite into the forest. And you see all the trees around, but the communities themselves are almost like the island of civilization with the forest around them, versus those communities where you can see a flow of green space and a flow of trees right throughout those communities. And I think that it's just interesting that the exchange of looking at the differences, the benefits of living in those two spaces, how that might influence planners' decisions in the future about how to integrate nature across those kinds of environments. So I think that idea of hand-holding is just a really nice way of thinking about that. And a lot of us can be handholders. The only thing I'd say there as well is that if you don't have the expertise or the wisdom or the confidence or the strength or the energy to be a handholder and to give to other people, another thing is that it's also fine sometimes to be a taker and to receive. And if you don't understand something, to be strong and courageous enough to ask, oh, what is that bird song? How do you get there? And that's fine. No one's expecting everyone to know everything. So knowing that you can reach out again to the outdoors team to ask for help to get started in something is another way in which you can give to others and give to nature by giving to yourself, right?
And it seems like something different inspires everybody. You know, something, as you were talking, I thought somewhere there's a community pretty close to here that you can just hop on the river walk and you could ride all the way to Lookout Mountain from here if you wanted to, or Camp Jordan now, even, yeah, I think.
There's one right there.
So we're kind of at the halfway point. So, you know, wouldn't that be the goal? But, you know, in some way, you're never too far from nature, especially in a city as great as Chattanooga.
Well, one of the goals is everyone within 10 minutes walk, isn't it?
So, you know, there's a 10-minute, you know, we kind of look at it as like parks close to home or nature that's close to homes, things too. But also, not everybody can get to national parks. I mean, yes, we do have the Smokies not too far away, but it's still a 3-hour drive to get up there. Other parks that are in South Carolina, the coastline stuff, though, not everybody can do those. So when you think of your city as a park, we see that we have a lot of similarities to what the Smoky Mountains have. Yeah, their mountains are bigger. They may have more salamanders than we do, but we still have a lot of the similarities. We've got a lot of salamanders, and we've got some good mountains that are around here. We got great mountain biking, and the list goes on and on. So exploring your backyard and also that availability is for anybody that moves here, anybody that lives here, that you don't have to travel to other locations. We encourage everybody to go to a national park, but not everybody has that opportunity, and you could do so here in your own park.
Yeah, if I can just pick up on that very briefly, is that I think that some people might think, without having thought it through, that they think that a national park is partially the absence of people. And I don't think we should define the value of a landscape as the absence of, like, your fellow community, right? So the fact that a town or city has supermarkets to get food and has boardwalks and paths, but also has the salamanders and the turtles and the mountains, means that it's accessible and more people can benefit from those things more often and have more opportunities to grow a relationship with it. So if you just think about it almost on a philosophical level, I think that actually in some ways that means that pound for pound, the value of nature and people's relationship with nature in an urban environment where people are eating, sleeping, working is even more important than maybe just visiting a national park to tick it off your list, being there, done that, and you leave without leaving a trace, having that consumer experience. But actually, that's not helping you in your day-to-day life, like on a day-to-day basis between, you know, your commutes and going to school, bringing up a child. Like, there are important moments visiting those national parks for many people. It's not the same as living in a space where you expect decent air, decent water, decent habitat.
That's a really amazing point, especially on this side of my little weekend getaway to Yosemite. What struck me about Yosemite, actually, and I think you said you've been there. You've not yet, but you'll love it when you go.
But it's amazing.
What struck me is it's very quiet. It's very sort of absent from animals in a way. You know, there are some. There's black bears and some things like that. But I was geeking out on my Merlin app because I'm a bird person myself. And there were only a couple here and there. And so I feel like I can really appreciate that point, that sort of like a landscape without animals, very similarly to even a landscape with animals, but without people. How beautiful would it be for all of us to be able to coexist? So I love what you guys have been doing, and so appreciate your time.
Yeah, and to be able to do that here in Chattanooga, to experience that nature, and to be able to walk in a walkway like this and listen to the birds and see nature that's around here, then, I mean, it's as I said, the competitive advantage that we have here in Chattanooga. See, it is a beautiful place to live. And again, are we perfect? No. Do we have more work to do? Absolutely. And we're not going to stop doing that, because if we're going to be this title, if we're going to be a livable city, if we're going to be the best outdoor town in America, then we need to own up to that and continue to work towards those goals. So, as I mentioned, continue to go where the puck is, where it's heading.
What's the best way if folks want to stay plugged into locally National Park City and what we're doing, and then beyond, what would be the best resources for that?
So locally, just go to ChattanoogaNationalParkCity.org, and that will talk a little bit more about what the campaign is, what the work we've been doing. You'll see the 7 commitments. You can sign the charter there, where you'll get a monthly newsletter. And then part of that also is a calendar that's built into that site that just shows all of the activities. We have Earth Week coming up starting tomorrow. There's almost 60 different things that people can do all next week with our partners and with the city and so forth. So plugging into that calendar, checking it out, that's a great way to just sort of give back to your city as well. So I would do that. And then, of course, for the National Park City Foundation, they've got their website as well, which I believe it is nationalparkcity.org, I believe. So
that's exactly right. So if anyone's listening to this, watching this, and is interested in their city becoming a national park city, or wants to get into the weeds of what those 23 criteria are, then it's just nationalparkcity.org, and we're on social media as well, so you can just search us out. Yeah.
Sounds great. Well, we have greatly appreciated your time and all the insight, and Dan being in Chattanooga, I didn't even realize that for the first time, and Brian, your years of work on this project, I know it must be very special and exciting.
It's exciting, but
came to fruition.
Yeah, it's now time to start the next chapter.
Sounds great. Well, thank you guys so much for tuning in. And if you're watching this or listening to this, we'll be repurposing it into a blog, of course, too, on prattliving.com. We so enjoy the thoughtfulness behind the homes and communities, and of course, behind the great city we're blessed to live in, too, of the greater Chattanooga area. So visit us on prattliving.com for more information, and check these great guys out as well. Thank you so much.
Get outside.